You're listening to Nick's Knacks on KFKA, hosted by Nick Kenny. Nick is the executive director of the Greeley Philharmonic Orchestra and the 2020 Greeley Area Chamber Ambassador of the Year. Nick's Knacks also touches on local and global issues through Nick's perspective, offering unique insights into the world's happenings. Prepare to learn something new in this thought-provoking and entertaining show.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Nick's Knacks on 1310 KFKA, Northern Colorado's Voice. I am not in the Auto Collision Specialist Studios today, but my good friend Scott Magerflesh is. I am calling in from Indiana, enjoying the holidays with my family. Made that long, arduous drive, which gave me plenty of time to really sink my teeth into the season finale of The Mandalorian, which we enjoyed thoroughly this previous Friday night. So this is our holiday week. This is a bit of an unorthodox, unscripted — these shows are never scripted anyway — just show. We're going to be talking The Mandalorian a lot, some of my and Scott's favorite episodes, favorite moments, best character development, and then talk about this big reveal from Disney that happened a couple of weeks ago and what that might mean for Mandalorian or any other show that may be very closely connected to The Mandalorian. So without further ado, again, we are here to talk about the finale of Mandalorian. And Scott, how's it going in the studio today?
Oh my gosh. I mean, you're talking about The Mandalorian. What in the world didn't happen? I was completely wrong. I talked last week about the possibility of Boba Fett, you know, betraying them, and that didn't happen. But holy cats, there was so much stuff to take in that, you know, 40 plus minute episode. I don't even know where to begin.
Well, let's just start at the beginning. We had a great cliffhanger with Mando getting the coordinates to Moff Gideon's light Imperial cruiser, and we get the opening sequence of a Lambda-class shuttle being chased by none other than Slave One, and I will not get sick of seeing Slave One on the television screen.
No, it was great.
I think that's just so much of a throwback from when we first see that ship detaching from the Super Star Destroyer that was Darth Vader's flagship in The Empire Strikes Back. And once you see Slave One follow the Millennium Falcon off to Bespin, you just couldn't get enough. And that's all we got until Episode 2, Attack of the Clones.
Yeah, you see it leave Cloud City, and that's it. And so to see it, you know, in all its glory for this episode, and, you know, they come out guns a-blazing and they're chasing the shuttle, and, you know, they hit it with the ion cannon. And for me, the best part of that whole sequence was when it goes quiet and they've got nothing, and then you just see Slave One rise up in their view screen in front of them, and it's just kind of ominous, and oh boy, and now it's on.
That felt like a throwback to me, and I can't still to this day place what that's from, but I don't know if it's from Independence Day, was the shield slowly rising, or what nod they had. That'd be worth exploring more, what kind of tribute, because there were a lot of throwbacks to other sci-fi series this whole season, plus again later on in this episode of Mandalorian. But yeah, that was just one of the jaw-dropping moments of seeing Slave One just slowly creep up in that viewpoint. So cool. And for the second time this season, we see how loyal Imperials are to the Empire, to the cause. And they had Dr. Pershing, of course, who we know from season one of Mandalorian, who's out to study the child or Grogu's blood, and, you know, midichlorian count, M count. My thoughts, I think, are how are they using that to help to bring back Palpatine? We kind of maybe got a bit of a disfigured Snoke in a couple of episodes ago, but we still don't know what exactly they were trying to do. I hope they end up tying that up. But you see the one pilot who doesn't want to be associated with the other Imperial pilot, and he gets shot in the back.
Yep.
The Empire's kind of cutthroat. I mean, Vader was the only one we saw actively kill another officer willingly, you know, for disobedience. And now we're seeing that more and more often after the fall of the Empire.
You're right. Well, and, you know, and then we also got to see some of the mocking, I guess, for lack of a better term, that the pilot was doing when he was talking about Alderaan. And, you know, and we understand now what the relevance is of the tiny tattoo, which was now we know is the survivors of Alderaan. And he, the pilot, references it while he's holding, you know, Dr. Pershing at gunpoint, but, you know, he just keeps mocking him. And I'm like, where do you think this is going? Because you're not going to win here. And obviously he doesn't when she's finally had enough and she takes down the pilot. But then it's almost like Dr. Pershing is like, hey, I'll follow whoever wants to help me. And he just is very quickly to give up the ghost when they're talking about those individuals. So I thought that was interesting.
Well, and when he was a clone creator, clone scientist, what they were doing was creating an army of good guys, mm-hmm. or at the time was good guys. So his service into the Empire, we don't really know. It all transitioned just like the clones did when Order 66 was issued. But he might have been forced to work for the Empire.
He
has no desire to continue what he's doing.
I gotcha. Okay. Sure. Okay. Well, and then we got to go after that. Then they go running off to pick up a couple more Mandalorians to help out. And man, I love that sequence, too. I thought it was great. And the banter back and forth and the communications and their interactions were just phenomenal.
Boba's got a chip on his shoulder. You can tell.
Well, and Bo-Katan, I mean, one of my favorite lines of the entire episode is like, you know, he's like, this armor was given to me by my father. And she's like, don't you mean your donor?
Just like, ouch. And he delivers so perfectly when she says, I've heard your voice 1,000 times, and he says, it'll be the last one you hear.
Yeah.
And it just, Temuera Morrison's voice is to me the most recognizable from the prequel trilogy. Mm-hmm. As you hear it from Django, and then all of those Star Wars games that came out, especially Battlefront, the first one on my trusty old PlayStation 2, you just hear his voice narrating the entire storyline of that game. So to me, that was around the time I was playing the most video games in my life. And his voice is, I think, the most Star Wars-y for me, other than, of course, Darth Vader, because there's nothing that can compare to Vader's voice. But we get that sequence and, you know, two Mandalorians walk into a bar. You know, I'm waiting for the punchline of that. They meet two more and two of them get in a fight. I don't know what the punchline is, but a great sequence there. You see Bo-Katan's ship. And one of my favorite shots of that whole show happened right after that bar scene is you get Slave One, Bo-Katan's ship, and the Imperial shuttle just in the backdrop of this desert island, not desert island, desert planet. And that was just cool. And you know, stuff's about to go down. And up to this point, we've seen Cara Dune, we've seen Bo-Katan and her henchwoman. We have Boba Fett and Fennec. That's a motley crew I would not want to mess with.
Nope.
As they're planning this incursion on Moff Gideon's ship, and of course Bo-Katan wasn't going to help out until one, she knew that Mando had the coordinates for Moff Gideon's ship, or two, that the Black Saber was there too.
Yep.
And she didn't seem interested to help Mando get the child back. I think everyone they've come across have sensed how important the child is to Mando, even going back to season one with Queel, the Ugnaught who sacrificed himself to protect Grogu way back in the penultimate episode of season one. And so here we are.
Yeah.
We're getting ready for something big to happen.
But again, to your point, she wasn't going to do anything until it was like, no, I can take you to Moff Gideon. And then she was completely in. And then she was like, but he's mine. And she said that over and over again. So
they staged the incursion up to the Imperial cruiser with another really cool shot. The cinematography for this episode was fantastic, but I loved when Slave One was in hyperspace and then it just kind of panned forward and you can see the Lambda class shuttle also just fractions of a second in front of them. If we're going by timing instead of actual distance, they come out of hyperspace and there's a little banter between Bo-Katan and Boba, which is, you know, pretty fantastic again of, you know, hope you're paying attention, princess, to he's putting on a good show. And he does, he comes out of hyperspace and fires a shot within a millisecond of leaving hyperspace and put on a pretty convincing show, but I don't think it was convincing enough for Moff Gideon.
No. And I think the kind of the tell in all of that is that, you know, he's watching it play out and, you know, she keeps asking for, you know, landing coordinates. And the moment that the Slave One breaks off and the shuttle's going for the launch tube and the two TIEs take off and then he takes them both out, you know, with shots behind him, I thought was pretty obvious. It's like, okay, everybody on screen, if they were paying attention, knows that the Slave One was just playing, because if it was able to take out the TIEs behind it that easily, it would have completely taken out the shuttle. So I think that's the little nod to the fans that are watching going, yeah, I think Moff Gideon's going to figure it out pretty quickly. So, but I loved the way they'd done it, because it was blatantly obvious. And then he jumps out and now we're on the cruiser.
The launch tube, that was a really good throwback to Battlestar Galactica, which we know Bo-Katan's character, played by Katie Sackhoff, was Starbuck in Battlestar Galactica, the latest rendition. So the launch tube was just such a similarity to how the fighters were launched in Battlestar. It was a really cool nod, I think, to try to include that. Just the brilliance behind the creative team of Mandalorian. So we get to land the shuttle to just crash land. Which was pretty cool to see. Yeah. Nice piloting by Bo-Katan, and they come out guns blazing, take out a couple of TIE pilots and stormtroopers and officers, and Gideon gives the order to charge the dark troopers.
Yep.
He didn't waste any time, because it takes several minutes to charge. And the diversion tactic, Mando went off to rescue Grogu, and they were all going to meet on the bridge. But as Scott, you just said, Bo-Katan wanted Moff Gideon for herself.
Mm-hmm.
Cara Dune wanted him to be kept alive because he's ex-ISB, and we know how bad they are. But Bo-Katan was stressing to the point, so you know that's gonna be a larger tell later on in the story.
Yeah, and she says, she's like, I don't care what happens to him as long as he surrenders to me. So it's building up that anticipated battle at the end of the interaction, which we find out a little later. Doesn't happen. It's like, oh, okay, that's not going to happen.
And we're getting so much just teasers, because as of this point of the episode, everything I expected to happen was panning out. You know, they were bringing back Bo-Katan, and they were assembling their team. I'm surprised Greef Karga wasn't a part of that, but it was a solid team, and maybe Greef would have held them back a little bit more. But before we go into more detail about what happens next in The Mandalorian, we'll just take a quick break and be back with more of this epic season finale from Mandalorian Season 2. Stay tuned to more Nick Snacks right after this. Welcome back to Nick Snacks here in this Christmas Eve as we're talking about The Mandalorian. Nick Snacks is proudly sponsored by 477 Distilling, located in downtown Greeley. There's still some time left to fill those stockings with some delicious spirits from 477 Distilling. They're currently running their 24 Days of Christmas special, so check them out on Facebook to see what deals you can snag right before before the time runs out for these last second gifts. We are here with Scott, not in the Auto Collision Specialist Studios, at least I'm not, phoning in from Fort Wayne, Indiana, and we're discussing The Mandalorian.
Surprise, surprise, you're phoning it in.
I don't know if that's a jab at me, Micah, but I'm hurt.
No, I'm
phoning?
Just joking.
Like E.T. phoning, or are you calling me a phony?
No, you're not a phony. You know what? You are the biggest Star Wars fan that I know. And that is a compliment, because I know... Don't give me that look. Philip over there is giving me a look like, hey, I'm the biggest... I don't know you that well. I know Nick more.
Fair enough.
You are the biggest Star Wars fan I know, so if I ever need to ask someone about Star Wars stuff that I don't know, I go to you and then complain about stuff.
That's true. You're very consistent. I appreciate that in the producer, Micah.
I do complain about a lot of things in Star Wars, but we won't go into that yet.
Yet.
So do Star Wars fans. It's kind of Star Wars fans are the best, but also the worst fans, because of how much they love it and how nitpicky they can be. I'm the same way. I admit it. There are some things I gripe about that I probably shouldn't, but there's also so much to love, especially after The Mando, after two seasons of this excellent show. That are just pumping new life into the Star Wars franchise. And I think that's what Disney had wanted all along after their acquisition of Star Wars, and I think it was 2015. Is that right, Scott?
Somewhere along those lines, I'd have to go back and research it. I'm not that big a fan that I know when that happened off the top of my head.
Because did Rogue One came out after Episode 7, right?
Yes.
The year after? Okay, so Episode 7 was 16, Rogue One was 17, we had 18, and then we had Solo, and then 19 we had Episode 9. Okay, sorry, I had to just think that through, audience. That's how I try to... That's what goes on when I'm trying to figure something out. Usually I'm not talking into a microphone during a live radio show.
And I think Disney's definitely doing the right thing now, making TV programs rather than releasing movies. Because Han Solo would have been so much better if they would have been able to go into things rather than just like 2 hours of him not really being Han Solo.
So before we get back into the Mando, yeah, it actually happened in 2013.
Okay, I knew it was an odd number.
Yeah, or actually in December of 2012 is what the interwebs are telling me. So Disney, you know, December 2012.
So that's what the Mayan calendar was pointing to.
There you go.
They were wrong.
They were wrong.
It was the end of Lucas.
Yep.
And the beginning of Disney.
I could see that, and it's taken them 8 years. Well, 7 years. They've had some really good things come out and also some rough things, but I'm really excited about their latest announcements. And yes, they are sort of marvelizing, if that's a word.
It is now.
I just created it. They're marvelizing Star Wars, which I think is what fans want. At first, when I was worried that, you know what, we'll talk about this a little later. We got Mando to talk about, and then we'll discuss Disney. So we're on the Imperial Cruiser. And we get some epic firefights, and Mando's task is to get rid of the dark troopers. Well, coming along with some scuffles around along the ship, great firefights. Scott, you had a good comment of, come on, stormtroopers, why? When you come up on a band of rebels on your ship, do you give them the time to freeze, hold, turn around? When they've just been shooting everybody so far.
They're kind of, you know, shoot first, ask questions later when, you know, whenever they're interacting with the Imperials. And the Imperials are always trying to arrest them and get them to freeze. So, you know, I think it reinforces who's really the bad guys in this, although I digress and we're getting off topic. But.
So those poor stormtroopers, they met their fate.
Getting mowed down right, left.
And, Mando comes across, Bo-Katan, they all take the bridge pretty easily, but Moff Gideon's not there. Mando comes and encounters a Dark Trooper, and now we get to see the Dark Troopers other than just, you know, using their feet rocket boosters like Iron Man and capturing Grogu a couple episodes ago. And now we get to see one of them escape their charging station, which, to me, it was nice to see that build-up and charging the Dark Troopers up, but... You know, at the point where they stepped off the ledge and their charging tubes popped off, they still took time to charge up. I don't know what that was about, but it did build some good suspense.
So I got to ask you, though, because of your musical background, what did you think of the music when they were going through that charging sequence? Because to me, I just thought it was perfect, and I absolutely loved every second of it, and I thought it fit the scene. But what did you think of that, the music?
It was a great buildup, and that's what you want before Star Wars came out. You weren't musical scores were not supposed to take viewers of a film away from what was happening on screen. It wasn't until John Williams came along truly that kind of wanted to match a musical score with what was happening on the screen. And then it's, to me, twice as good when the music fits so well with what's happening on screen. And John Williams is so notorious for that, which is why he has some of the best soundtracks of all time. And since then, scoring music for major films and cinema has changed drastically, and that's more of the way it goes. And I think this was perfect. The music for this show has rivaled, but it's so different too from the Star Wars composers we've had. We've had three now, Michael Giacchino, and John Williams, of course, and the one who does Mando, who's got a really nice, interesting name.
Didn't John Powell? Solo. I thought John Powell.
Did Solo.
Yeah, did Solo. I actually liked John Powell sounded a lot more like John Williams than Michael did.
I would agree with that. But for this one, even with, because they don't have a full orchestra like they normally do, you know, there was a great docuseries on it in the first season of how they would score the music, and it, that's one I would recommend over and over again. But Scott, to your point, it was great. It was a good buildup, and you have to have that suspense when you're about to unleash the dark troopers. Mando almost gets there, and one gets out.
Yep.
And Mando, he had his hands full. He really could have used Grogu there to he was getting his behind handed to him, just like the Mudhorn in season one.
Yep.
I didn't know if he was going to make it. I was worried about his helmet just getting smashed up and punched up against the wall, and you see the metal buckling behind his head. I said he's going to come out looking like he did in the finale of season one, but Beskar held up pretty well. Great, great, great fight scene. He's got his Beskar pike?
Spear.
What do you call that? Spear?
Spear, pike, whatever. Yeah.
And there's a point where he kicks it back and spins it up over his shoulder, and it was just a really neat battle sequence against that Dark Trooper, and he ends up defeating it and blowing the airlock to get rid of all the other ones, which was nice. And then comes across Moff Gideon with Grogu, and just Mando's a little too trusting, Scott. A little too trusting.
Well, and you know, I was really worried, and I'm glad that my worries were unfounded when he launched the Dark Troopers out into space. I'm like, that can't be it. That can't be it. You know, they're droids. You know, they can't be done with this. And it's like, how are they going to bring this back? And, you know, so for me, I love the fact that it created that suspenseful moment so that he can have that exchange with Moff Gideon. But at the end of the day, they came back and they created a bigger buildup later on towards the end of the episode. So love that.
We're still not even at the end of the episode, but we have some commercial break. We'll be back in just a moment as we wrap up this epic finale of The Mandalorian Season 2 here on Nick Snacks with Nick Kenny on 1310 KFKA. Welcome back to Nick Snacks here on 1310 KFKA, Northern Colorado's voice, here in the Auto Collision Specialist Studios, or Scott and Micah, as I am from afar. And we still have more to talk about The Mandalorian. We had mentioned in the previous segment the Dark Troopers getting blasted off into space. They do make a triumphant return shortly after a nice scuffle between Moff Gideon and Mandalorian, but that's a really strange place where they re-enter, Scott, is what starship has no guardrails and just this open access to space? What are they doing there?
Well, you know, there's not a lot of union laws in the Empire.
Well, look at the Death Star. The Death Star was like that, too. And so that Death Planet, like, they didn't have a lot of guardrails.
Well, but okay. So
they're saving metal.
Just thought of this. Think back to the Siege episode where he goes back to Navarro. And you remember where Mithril says, hey, no guardrails. So, I mean, they literally set that up three episodes earlier that they literally don't care about them. However, at the top of that, when he was escaping, there was a guardrail around one of the stormtroopers, you know, when Mando blasts out. So I'm not sure. Maybe it's hit or miss. It's put one there, and maybe it's a cost-cutting measure. I don't know.
That's what I think.
Who knows? Yeah, that's probably so, especially at this stage with the Empire. But and again, if it weren't there, it would make for – they'd have to find another way to bring in the Dark Troopers. Mando just gets bamboozled again by somebody else out-talking him. And Moff Gideon puts on a very good speech about he's used the child for everything it needed. It just needed his blood. He's welcome to take him. Just get off the ship. Well, and then when Mando's back is turned ever so slowly, you think he'd move a little quicker and have his eye constantly on Moff Gideon. But again, you need that good story and that suspenseful buildup. And then we get a really good battle between Moff Gideon and Mando. Mando, of course, with his Beskar spear, spike, pike.
Whichever.
It's kind of, a pure Beskar. He's holding up against the Darksaber really nicely. And Moff Gideon's got some moves, but he can't take down Mando.
No.
And Mando is too good of a person to take down Moff Gideon.
You know, and I thought that was really interesting, and I love the way they did it from a storytelling perspective, you know, because obviously, you know, Cara Dune wants him alive, and so he's kind of honoring that. But when Gideon looks up at him and he says, oh, you're keeping me alive. You're letting me live. This should be interesting, because he knows what's coming. And it's really wild to kind of see how that plays out. And I really enjoyed some of that dialogue that was built into there that really reinforced what was happening. But going back to what he said in the cell, he goes, assume that I know everything. And once again, he was kind of a couple steps ahead. And it was great to see that. I thought, you know, Giancarlo is just an amazing actor, and the way that he acted without speaking a lot of times in this episode was amazing.
I wish with him, because I love characters who are multiple steps ahead of their enemies. And in this case, the enemy was Mando, and that's somebody we're cheering for. And that's why I like Grand Admiral Thrawn's character so much in the Clone Wars and Rebels episodes, because he was always, sorry, just Rebels. He wasn't in Clone Wars. He was always a few steps ahead of everyone else. And that's why I'm so fascinated by his character. Giancarlo Esposito is Thrawn 2.0.
Yeah.
Now he's in custody of Mando, but you know there was something more to him. Why was he with Grogu? And later we find out on the bridge, the dark saber belongs to Mando now, because he defeated Moff Gideon, who defeated Bo-Katan. We don't know exactly how yet, but that's what Bo-Katan is after, because whoever has the dark saber is the true and rightful ruler of Mandalore.
Yep. And that's why she wanted it. I mean, that was why she made a big deal about, you know, Gideon's mine as long as he, you know, surrenders to me. And that didn't happen. And so the interaction between, you know, Din Djarin and Bo-Katan on the bridge, when they're looking at each other, you can tell, you know, she wants what he's got and he doesn't want what he has. And there's an unresolved conflict there that's going to have to work itself out. And I love the fact that we don't know how it's going to work itself out yet.
I like, and I don't know if this was intentional or not, I just finished Game of Thrones, and Pedro Pascal played over in Tyrell. I think it was Tyrell. And gets his head crushed by the mountain. But
it's Martell.
He did not... Martell, yeah. Tyrells are a different family. He did not... the mountain did not yield to him, and he would have refused to yield. You know, he wanted that confession. He was egging him on. And for Mando to quickly yield was in Mando's character, but I don't know if that was some kind of connection to how quickly he yielded the Darksaber to Bo-Katan. Maybe that's just me looking into something a little too closely, but with how many throwbacks there have been to sci-fi series, I'd like to think there was a little nudge there to his character in Game of Thrones. But there's just visible tension between Bo-Katan and Mando, but Mando can't sense it. He just wants to give it away. Yeah. He has no desire whatsoever to...
Yeah. He doesn't want it. He's like, you know, here, you have it. And it's like, oh, she can't take it. He's like, well, I yield. I literally don't want it. And so, you know, and I really think if you go back to the, you know, to the stories that we saw in Clone Wars, when Sabine gives it to her, she accepts it. And then obviously something happens and she loses it. And so for me, I think the story behind the story is that she lost it and probably believes that she lost it so easily, whether it's to Moff Gideon or however it got into his possession, because she didn't win it in combat. And so that's why she is completely unwilling to take it out of his hands without that combat, because she feels like she lost it the first time. And again, I'm speculating, but I really think that's where the story is going to unfold later. And maybe we'll figure out how she lost it. But I really think that's part of the reason why she wouldn't take it and was so apprehensive about it in those moments.
Well, and I think that's kind of where you see how strongly her beliefs are for the dark saber. We know Mando and his cult of Mandalorians, you know, is not supposed to take the helmet off. People aren't supposed to see his face. We get a lot more of that this season with the latest episodes and Bo-Katan. I wonder if her beliefs are too strong that you do have to win the dark saber in combat. It's not like the thing's not going to turn on if she holds it. It's just the story that's told with how it was won. I think it's a noble enough story to say, well, it wasn't surrendered to me, but it was yielded to me by the guy who defeated him, who has no interest in doing this. But I was on a mission to save a child, this foundling, Grogu to get him to the Jedi.
Yeah, and I think Gideon, you know, did that for us when he said, oh, you know, the saber doesn't have power, the story does. And so I really think that's where we're going to see that, that it has nothing to do with, you know, the fact that she has it. It has everything to do with how she got it.
Can't they have a fake fight? Can't he be like, well, I'll fight you for it. Oh, but darn
again,
it.
I think
you've defeated me. Well, I'm going to take my baby and leave.
It kills the story. And again, that's where Bo is very convicted and Din Djarin isn't. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
I've been known to host a pretty reputable rock, paper, scissors tournament. So I wonder if I can't make my offerings to get a character in season 3 of Mando hosting a rock, paper, scissors.
You think Favreau and Filoni would be Bo. Okay with that? That resolution?
I think so. If they heard the show once, they might just pity me to give me any kind of attention on The Mandalorian. That's where nerds look out for each other. It's just what we do. Now, we don't have much time left in this segment, but then we get the best surprise, I think, in all of in the past 8 years of Disney having Star Wars. And we'll get to that in just a moment as we wrap up this final episode of Nick Snacks for the year, I think. Just stay tuned for more on 1310 KFKA, Northern Colorado's Voice. Welcome back to Nick Snacks, wrapping up the last episode of the year here on 1310 KFKA. Nick Snacks is proudly sponsored by 477 Distilling. Hoping you're all enjoying this Christmas Eve. Hopefully you're able to gather with some friends and family as safely as possible this holiday season. Knowing that there's light at the end of the tunnel and we'll be back to normal, hopefully, in a blink of an eye. But we've got lots of Star Wars to talk about before that point, which has really helped us get through the last couple months of this COVID time, at least for me and Scott. It's been the highlight of my week, getting together and watching the latest episode of The Mandalorian.
Agreed.
So we know somebody has to come. We get the epic superhero pose from the Dark Troopers when they come back into the ship. It looks just like Iron Man, you know, landing, about to take on Thanos or some other big baddie from the Marvel series. That was just so Disney hashtag 2010s, something we've seen dozens of times. And, well, they're starting to bash the door down. We knew blasters weren't going to do much against the Dark Troopers. Everyone's in the bridge. Moff Gideon's just kind of antagonizing everybody. And everyone's on edge. And then, you know, we get this little bleep, 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 bleep from the sensors. And lo and behold, a rogue X-Wing comes flying in. So already triggered in my brain is, that's only one X-Wing. Surely it's not one of the New Republic fighter pilots we've seen this season. That could be somebody I know. And then you see this hooded figure get out and just start slashing away at the Dark Troopers. Not going to play this out. I mean, it was Luke Skywalker.
Yeah.
And we kind of saw the hilt. We saw the glove on his right hand. We know he lost that and wore a glove. We see that explicitly on Jabba's sail barge in The Return of the Jedi, where he gets shot in the hand and pulls his glove up over it. And then again, when he's going to see Yoda for the last time, because he doesn't want Yoda to see that he lost his hand. You know, he was embarrassed because Vader lost his hand. He didn't want to see. He was seeing himself more and more like Vader the second time he went to visit Yoda on Dagobah. But that's a sidetrack there. We get Luke Skywalker. And we get Luke Skywalker as I think George Lucas wanted us to always view Luke Skywalker, as just a Jedi Knight, a fighter, a survivor, an opponent to somebody like Darth Vader, to these Dark Troopers, a whole garrison of them. Was awesome to see Luke Skywalker in his prime.
It was great. And, you know, I think when we were watching it, I was going through those moments of going, no, it can't be him. No, I think it's him. No, it can't be him. It is him. And the other thing that I really took away from it was the parallels between Luke and Vader, between the scenes that we've seen in the end of Rogue One, where he just goes in and decimates all the Rebel fleet troopers, and when Luke's doing it at, you know, on the light cruiser, it just, there were so many parallels to that all across the board, including, you know, when he gets to the very last one and he just holds out his hand and just crushes it from the inside. And it reminded me of that scene where Vader's lifting up the Rebel fleet trooper, you know, at the end of Rogue One. And then, of course, you know, the doors open and Luke's standing there with the mist behind him, and he's got that ominous look. And it's almost identical to the scene that we see in Rogue One when Vader first reveals himself to the Rebel fleet troopers. So, again, I think it was a lot of parallelism that they were using to show that these are, you know, father-son.
And even more parallel, the CGI was so bad, it was parallel to Princess Leia going, "Hope." I mean, that was horrible. That took me out. I was into the episode. I was loving the episode. It was one of my favorite episodes. And then suddenly I'm like, oh, I hate this thing now. It was that
bad.
Well,
we won't get into that. The CGI we can all question because there's some actors, Sebastian Stan for one, who looks just like a young Mark Hamill. But it was so fitting for me to have Luke Skywalker come. It bridges and connects the original trilogy with what's happening now, this new age of Star Wars. My dad, who loved the original trilogy, said that was the best thing I've seen in Star Wars. He hasn't cared much for it because they brought back Luke, and that was the reason why. And I know that I've seen a lot of shade thrown at J.J. Abrams saying you can't bring in a new audience of Star Wars fans while still honoring the original trilogy. Well, Dave and John just did, and it was great. Yeah. It wouldn't have made sense for really any other Jedi. Even if Mace Windu's alive, it would have been shocking to see Mace after all this time to make an appearance. Ezra Bridger from Rebels is gone. We know he might be back because Thrawn's back, but Ezra, I don't think, would be ready to take on a Padawan. He was barely more than a Padawan at the end of Rebels. Ahsoka has said she's not interested in taking on Grogu. I couldn't think of any other Jedi befitting enough for it to be anyone other than Luke Skywalker. And that was great. And I think even if we don't see Grogu again, we know he's in good hands. We don't know when he's going to graduate from Luke's School of Jedi or if he survives Kylo Ren's attack. Yeah. But as Scott said, this could be the seed for the next 800 years worth of Star Wars storytelling with a young Grogu who could easily live to almost 1,000 years old.
Yeah.
Do you think he's going to teach him proper sentence structure?
I don't know.
We can circle back. Yeah. That was a very, very touching moment between Grogu and Pedro Pascal and the Mandalorian, and it was just him taking his helmet off in front of everybody. Boba Fett and Cara Dune. He took his helmet off again just last episode, and Mayfield has said, "Hey, you did what you had to do. I'll never tell anyone about this." So, you know, in Mando's eyes, okay, that was the one and done. He's taken his helmet off. And then he did it in front of everybody. And it was a great moment between Grogu, and he touches his face and, you know, nice and powerful, get the swells of music, and then for it to go dark. Just a great wrap up of this series, of this season, not the series. And wondering what's next. But we get a little teaser at the end of credits, which is something Marvel's notorious for, and I'm glad that I watched it. And it was a trusted planet we've seen 42 years ago. Well, yep. I wasn't around then, but
I was almost
the twin
born.
Sons,
yep,
almost of Tatooine, and we're at Jabba's palace and some gunfire. We see a blaster fire. Fennec come in and take out the guards. What I think was Boba Fett's girlfriend in Return of the Jedi. Yep. It was in the background, and a Bib Fortuna who really let himself go after Jabba's passing.
Yes, he did.
So whatever cartel is still being run out of Jabba's palace is no more. Boba Fett comes in, and fans have been upset with Boba this whole season about, well, he's not the Boba Fett I remember. We don't really know much about Boba Fett, just what we've created in our own minds over the past 40 years since his introduction at the holiday special. So I think I loved Boba's character development this season, but he came back and just put a blaster bolt right between Bib Fortuna's, girth. Rolls.
Yep. And then he just sits down. And he's like, I'm now the king of the castle. And, you know, I love Fennec's look when she kind of grabs the liquor behind him and sits on the chair next to him. And she's like, yeah, we got this. And I, you know, thought it was a great way to your point, work on that character that we've expected to be this really nefarious bad guy, doesn't answer to anybody. And he really became that after he sort of, you know, paid off his debt to Din Djarin to get his armor back. So I love the fact that we're going to see that, and we're going to see it in a different way, I think, going forward with the book of Boba Fett.
And that's coming out next December. So Mandalorian will not be back until 2022.
No, Christmas. They said Christmas next year for
it's being filmed after the book of Boba Fett, because there'll be a mini series of Boba Fett. So Mando with the same creative team will be filmed right after that. Whew, I had a little panic moment there, Scott. Thank you.
We'll get both next year. That'll be awesome.
There's so much more to talk about. Might just have a special show next week just to continue discussing, because there was so much Scott and I didn't get into tonight. But hopefully you enjoyed our recaps of The Mandalorian the past 8 weeks. Hopefully you enjoyed the season as much as I have, as much as Scott had. We have a little bit of time before next season, but a lot of Star Wars to discuss very soon. I hope you all have a very Merry Christmas, a Happy New Year if I'm not on next week. I appreciate your listening, and as always, enjoy The Mandalorian, enjoy everything there is, and wrap up 2020 with a smile. This has been Nick Kenny on 1310 KFKA, and that's our cutoff.